Encephalitis, Lyme disease, HIV, these are ugly ailments to experience. But if you look through a high-powered microscope, it's possible to find beauty in disease. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, art inspired by nature and community. We'll start with pieces of jewelry inspired by infectious disease. It's the result of a collaboration between artist Mark Ginsberg and the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. Later, I'll talk with painter and woodworker William Close about his work inspired by Iowa's landscape, and finally, a large-scale collaborative art project in Davenport. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, art inspired by nature and community. I'll talk with painter and woodworker William Close of New Hartford later in the hour, and we'll find out about a large-scale collaborative art project at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. But we're going to start with art that is beautiful and sinister, pieces of jewelry inspired by infectious disease. Mark Ginsberg is a jeweler and the owner of MC Ginsberg Objects of Art in Iowa City. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Charity.
And in a conversation about art, I usually don't introduce a doctor, but Dr. Maggie Chirazi is also here. She's an associate professor of epidemiology at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. Hello, Dr. Chirazi.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And since clearly there was a collaboration here between you, Mark, and the College of Public Health, tell me how this project got started for you.
It's actually been a slow evolution, but I've constantly looked at different geometries and electron microscope slides and different slides of biology, and it intrigues me, the shapes. I'm looking for things that we can make into pieces of jewelry. And as we got into more complex forms, it dawned on me, and I was friendly with Sue Curry and still am friendly with Sue Curry, that if we went down the pathogen route, what an interesting discussion it would make to juxtapose the ruthlessness of the pathogen with the beauty of the art. So one thing led to the next, and I sat down with the staff at the College of Public Health, and we started exploring different forms and make sure that the models were accurate. We worked with epidemiologists and infectious disease and microbiologists to make sure that we were looking at something that was relevant and accurate.
Can you tell me what disease or what parasite, what first caught your attention that made you think, wow, that's beautiful and horrible at the same time?
Well, when I looked at the form, originally I was looking at the H1N5 pathogen, the influenza. I was intrigued both by the needles and the grape-like structures. And the granulation of the grape-like structures actually reminded me of the Etruscans in the Etruscan Revival period, and when they were unearthing Herculaneum. So I get on these little deviations that take me far away from public health. But in custom design jewelry, the complexity of construction really mixes well, it interacts well with science. And when I started looking at some of these structures, it dawned on me that we could make beautiful pieces of jewelry or even decorative sculptures just to sit on a desk or to hang on a neck. That actually educated, you know, all of us out there, it didn't matter what age, and as well as pronouncing a benefit to the College of Public Health by, in this case, we're giving away all the profits to the College of Public Health in hopes that someday we'll endow a chair.
And Dr. Chirazi, how did you first get involved in this project?
Yeah, well, the college approached me mostly as a sort of content expert. First, I was asked to provide images that would serve as sort of the inspiration for Mark's models, and then to provide some of the public health message behind the pathogens that were featured.
So in all the years that you've been looking through a microscope, did you ever think, boy, I'd like a pair of influenza earrings?
I had never imagined it, but I have oftentimes looked at images of influenza or some of the parasites that are out there and thought these are really strikingly beautiful images on their own.
So, Mark, once you identify an image that you think is beautiful, that you think you could turn into something beautiful, how do you go about modeling it?
We have to make a three-dimensional model. So basically what we start with is the two-dimensional model that Maggie supplies us or somebody else from the department, and we try to extrude it to make sure that from all the sides, basically – do you remember the old Play-Doh machines where you put the lump of Play-Doh and you extruded it through the holes? So basically we're taking a flat object and we're either converting it into a sphere or into an elongated box or however, but we're adding dimension to it. So we look at the X and the Y on paper, and then we're not trying to guess on the Z or the depth. We actually work closely with Maggie or some of the other doctors or epidemiologists at the department to make sure that the model is accurate from all sides. And typically they'll give us pictures of images from the cube environment so that we're able to see it. So it's like taking a look through the ViewMaster in essence. But we're taking this and then we're making a computer-aided design model. And we're doing the drawings, sending it back to College of Public Health for verification. Then we're printing it, sending it back to Public Health for them to look at the models.
And when you say printing it, you're printing a 3D model.
So we have 3D. We have two 3D printers, one that prints in a castable resin that allows us to sprue it up on a wax finger, put it into an investment or a plaster mold, burn it out in an oven, and then pour molten metals, whatever metal we want to use in the center. Into that, or we have a photopolymer printer that allows us to print in anything from a silicone-like photopolymer to an ABS hard plastic. And I brought some examples. You can't see it on the radio, but you can describe it. So they look very alien, almost as if you know when they show the slow motion sneezes on a commercial on TV, and they show the pathogens spreading out. Similar to that, I don't know. Some might not find beauty in that, but. In any case, if you think of these forms, and I initially thought of them as large Christo-esque forms, like 50 feet tall, water fountains and things like that, they're actually stunning and quite beautiful. And so I pursued going down that direction. But initially, just to make sure we had accuracy in the model and there was something here relevant to learn from, we wanted to make sure the College of Public Health was involved. And I don't know that we initially set out to make it into a fundraising or philanthropic or endowment type of a campaign, but the site that we're setting up right now is geared to just that. Actually, it's a long shot that we'll raise the amount of money we need to endow a chair, but if, at the very least, hopefully, with Maggie's help and Sue Curry and Dan McMillan and everybody else over at the College of Public Health that's working with us, we'll raise awareness of the field and the profession and the challenges. And I think that's, you know, we talk about STEM, you know, the science, technology, engineering, and math. I really think it should be STEAM. So science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Because without art, and I think Einstein said this, there are no solutions. So if we can get people intrigued with the art, perhaps they'll follow up with finding a profession in the science.
Well, and clearly what you, the process you have described is one that I have talked about with other 3D modelers who are engineers and working in completely different fields. But you're bringing a lot of science and engineering into this artistic process.
For me, it's delightful to work with the disparate skill sets. I mean, having Maggie look over my shoulder and make sure that what we're doing from an artistic standpoint has some relevance makes my job much more interesting and fluid, as opposed to purchasing something that's already made, putting it into a case, and then whether you like it or not, you have to buy it, the kind of thing. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, all of us are doing that in the jewelry store. That's why we dropped the title jewelry, because to me it wasn't as interesting to create works of art or purchase ready-made pieces. It made more sense for me to purchase or to create something that wasn't done yet. And to wear an HIV or to wear a Giardia pin or Aspergillus creates not only, you know, beauty that you can wear on your shirt sleeve, if you will, but also break the ice. You know, it's a slow party. That's, you know, have you seen my Aspergillus?
Aspergillus is a fungi? What is?
It's a mold. You explain.
Yeah, it's
that.
A mold. It's a fungi.
Okay. And then Giardia is a parasite that causes a lot of discomfort and fatigue.
Not
people,
fun.
To people who drink water that have it in it.
Yeah.
Dr. Chirazi, You have, of course, seen a lot of these pathogens through a microscope. You have seen a lot of images of these. Are 3D models something that are part of the classroom experience as you get your training?
It really hasn't been. It's more hands-on microscopic work. You know, if I think back to my days as an undergrad in microbiology courses, you know, every now and then you actually have a live organism. You know, in my classes, I take students out into the field and we collect ticks, and ticks are one of our models. So that's sort of fun for them to see. But no, more often than not, it's a pretty static experience.
So what is it like to get one of these 3D models and look at something that you have seen in two dimensions often?
It's awe-inspiring. It's fun. It's a great way to engage my friends and, you know, the public. And I really look forward to just being able to hold it and to, you know, show a person, hey, this is influenza. Or when I see Dean Curry walking around with her HIV, you know, pendant necklace, you can start a conversation, you know, as Mark said, you can start a conversation with that. It's a great way to get the public health message out and to start to educate the public and raise awareness. That's one of our core missions as a College of Public Health, is to educate the public.
Is anyone at the College of Public Health starting to bring these 3D models into the classroom?
I don't know that we've considered that, but if anybody would, it would be me. So I teach the course in Epidemiology of Infectious Diseases. Today's our first day of class.
Okay.
So maybe my students can look forward to that.
I'll have to loan you some of these.
I'll have to ask Mark for a loaner.
So when you look at the influenza virus, and if you go to our Facebook page, you can click through and you can see links to some of the beautiful pieces of art that you have created, and also some of the images that have inspired those. So you look at influenza, for example, or you look at HIV, and to my very untrained eye, they are quite similar. Why would you want to make the distinction as an artist, Mark?
Well, there are two reasons. There's a little bit of difference in the geometry, and depending on which strain of influenza that we use. We start off originally with the H1N5 or H1N1, Maggie?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little bit more difficult to assemble the model without some of the spikes or the needles breaking. So we went to something that had a little more blunt surface, and it ended up looking more like the HIV. So that was more coincidental than planned. But even if you look closely, I've gotten, and I have not a trained eye whatsoever, I've gotten used to looking at the models and being able to pick up the differences in the influenza and the HIV. So even some of these subtle differences, but we realize that we're looking at two different disciplines in epidemiology or infectious disease. So somebody would study HIV and be intrigued by that. And maybe somebody has a person that they've known that has HIV and wants this as kind of a their talisman, you know, and to wear it as a work of art, and not to forget, you know, that we're still looking for cures for this kind of thing, or at least to stave off the disease. And the same thing with influenza.
We have to take a quick break here. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Mark Ginsberg. He's the owner of M.C. Ginsberg Objects of Art in Iowa City, and Dr. Maggie Chirazi. She's an associate professor of epidemiology at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. We're talking about jewelry inspired by infectious disease. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about art inspired by nature and community. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with painter and woodworker William Close of New Hartford. But right now with me, Mark Ginsberg. He is the owner of N.C. Ginsberg Objects of Art in Iowa City. And Dr. Maggie Chirazi, an associate professor of epidemiology at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about jewelry and art inspired by infectious disease. And you can see some of this art if you click through on our Facebook page, Deadly Pathogens or Works of Art at M.C. Ginsberg. You can also go to infectiousart.com and find out more about this as well. Now, Mark, with your 3D printer, I know that you've also had other projects that you've worked on with the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. What kinds of things can you do with this modeling that can really benefit the medical world?
I think it's, you know, and Maggie actually hit on this, the educational opportunities to have a physical three-dimensional object in front of you is truly worth 1,000 words. And when you're looking at that, it is awe-inspiring to think we have Giardia that we can wear on a lapel that's 7 million times its original size, and we can blow it up into a jungle gym if we want, or wear it as a piece of jewelry, or just set it on our desk. But we've been working with interventional pediatric cardiology for pre-gaming. Some of the surgeries are a little more difficult, and at the very least, bringing some of the models that are much more relevant and accurate to the classroom, which a lot of the third and fourth year students, when they're introduced to the models, never get a chance to see the actual anatomy. Everything is kind of a dumbed down version of an average, and specifically not pediatrics. Everything's adult sizes.
So when you say pre-gaming a surgery, you can make a model of a specific heart with a specific problem?
When it comes to pediatrics, they use echocardiograms more frequently than CT scans or MR images because of the radiation. So we actually take the low resolution echocardiogram, and it's, if you think of panes of glass, those are the data sets. And we actually assemble those into a three-dimensional model in a computer-aided design environment and then print it. We have to have that obviously in advance of the surgery, and they've got to make sure that they're taking all the identity off of the x-rays or anything that they use, so that we get an anonymous plate. And then we can assemble the data sets, make the model, return it back to the surgeon, and they can look at it with their team and say, we've got an anomaly here, we've got something abnormal here, or even if we have something normal, here's how we're going to attack the surgery, here's the angle we're going to go in. And you can't do that with a two-dimensional object. But with three-dimensional, you can actually angle your tool in advance of going Wow. into the heart and or to any organ or any part of the body.
It's not the same, but you can actually have a practice run.
You can have the exact physiology, is the accuracy of the CT scan or the MR or the echocardiogram or the x-ray is what we depend on. So the more accurate that is, the more accurate the model. But if anything, we have to dumb down the three-dimensional print to reflect what the surgeon is seeing in the virtual world or the epidemiologist. So the more accurate the models are, we can print that. And we're printing in layers of 16 microns, which is the width of a human hair. So we're printing layers that thin, and we're getting resolution that's 200ths of a millimeter. And if Wow. you look at that, it's about on a dots per inch is about 600 dpi. So you could blow it up to a billboard size and not lose resolution. It's impressive.
You've already mentioned that you think that there is this intersection with art and science and engineering that we shouldn't overlook as a society. For you personally, what's the continuum? I mean, you began as an artist, but clearly this is science that we're talking
about.
Well,
Henry Moore, the sculptor, said that we must have a task in our lives, one that gets us out of bed and one that propels us forward. And it's got to be something we can never possibly finish. So for me, having the opportunity to bump into Maggie or to Sue Curry or Dan McMillan or to Abe Divakar or Ibrahim Osbalat or Kareem Malik, these people at the university who I would never have had the occasion to meet just in a jewelry environment, is intriguing, and also opens me and my staff, which is now mechanical engineer, biomedical engineer, MFAs in sculpting and ceramics and metals, the opportunity to cross-polarize and intersect some of these other disciplines. And we're going down the science field and the physics field, but this could be automotive, it could be consumers and consumables and really anything. So the field and the world to me is infinite, where it may have been vertically siloed by my own prejudice.
Right. Well, Dr. Chirazi, from your side, being in a scientific world and now participating in an artistic venture, how does that change how you see this intersection?
For me, science hasn't always been dissected from art. I sort of grew up with an artistic background, and I appreciate the beauty of the imagery. But to be able to see it and to hold it and to experience it, it's been really rewarding personally to be a part of this project.
We have an email from Jeff. He says, plushy microbes have been around for a while, not as much 3D modeling, but a lot of cuteness. And in this conversation, I've also been thinking about I don't know if the trend is still going, but there was a trend for a little while. You saw necklaces of chemical formulas, so for serotonin or caffeine. Was this idea at all inspired by that interest in people of wearing scientific formulas?
I think I'm going to paraphrase again. Woody Guthrie said that plagiarism is basic to all culture. And I think from that perspective, it's hard for us not to, if we open our minds and our hearts to you know, meeting other people and other cultures to be affected and be inspired by someone or some other group. So for me, Luke Jerram, who's he's an English artist who's done some phenomenal work, is the first person that I read about doing some work with pathogens and bringing that to the forefront and working with microbiologists and epidemiologists, et cetera. So the field is open. And I think anybody who has an idea can email myself or Sue Curry or Dr. Tarazi and let us know if there's some other direction they'd like us to go. But hopefully this will inspire others to do something on their own or with us.
It does seem like the options are endless in this field.
Right.
Do you find yourself looking around for what's the next thing I want to turn into?
The curse of creativity is no sleep. So I find myself learning how to sleep less and less. And I don't know about others that, you know, are passionate about the fields. But for me, with a degree in history and to meet astrophysicists and microbiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons, epidemiologists is absolutely fascinating.
All right. And if you come into a room wearing HIV cufflinks, or if I walk into a room wearing Giardia earrings, what do you want people to see when they look at that jewelry?
Just the beauty or the intriguing uniqueness of the geometry that you're wearing, the fact that you're, you know, it is something about your soul, something about inside of you that says, this is who I am. I'm not looking to be like everybody else on this planet. So I have found something that is intriguing that not everybody on the planet has, although we're going to hopefully get everybody on the planet to wear one of these pieces. But in the short term, not everybody has this. So it's nice to be at the front end of an adventure that we never know where's it going to go. So whether it's clothing or whether it's something decorative or whether it's a piece of art, it says something about you that you've looked beyond your front yard into a world that either is not seeable, is subatomic, or is, you know, so small we can't see the particles, or so grandiose that we never thought about it. But in any case, it allows us to understand how to heighten our perception. We've really deadened it with the internet and with malls and everything that's like that. To me, I'm trying to get away from the antiseptic and sterile world of no interest, and everything's plainer and there's so much homogeny. I'd like to see some texture. I'd like to see a world without prejudice to design and to science and to art. I'd like to see disparate teams connect the dots. And so I have a studio artist working with a biomedical engineer, working with an epidemiologist, working with an astrophysicist, working with a historian, working with somebody in comparative literature. And why can't you assemble teams like that?
Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity.
Mark Ginsburg is a jeweler, an artist, and the owner of MC Ginsburg Objects of Art in Iowa City. Dr. Maggie Tarazi, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Tarazi is an associate professor of epidemiology at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. Again, you can see these pieces of art on our Facebook page. You can click through on the link, or you can go to infectiousart.com, and the profits from selling this beautiful jewelry will be donated back to the University of Iowa's College of Public Health. This is Talk of Iowa. My next guest takes inspiration from the Iowa landscape and other beautiful parts of the Midwest. Painter and woodworker William Close of New Hartford. Although for those of us who went to Pete Junior High in Cedar Falls, we knew him as Mr. Close. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's wonderful to be here.
And you did spend 33 years teaching art at Pete Junior High in Cedar Falls. As an artist and an art teacher, for all of those years, how were you able to integrate your own art into what I'm sure was very absorbing work?
I always felt that it was important for my students to recognize that I was a practicing artist and that I was continually developing my skills. I think that gave me great credibility in the classroom. I wanted to we've been using the word infectious lately. So I wanted art to become infectious from me to my students.
Did you find yourself taking inspiration from some of the things that your students did?
You always learn from your students. So absolutely. Every junior high student comes in with different baggage. And it was my role as an art teacher, and especially at the junior high level, to be able to capitalize on the backgrounds and the interests of the students that came into my classroom, and to help them find how they can transfer the things that they know into works of art.
Well, and you also, for anyone who lived in Cedar Falls or traveled through Cedar Falls, you were in part responsible for those giant sculptures that, that the art students would create every year, a two-story sneaker, or many. I mean, there were so many of them. The giant master lock, so many different things that got blown up, way, way larger than life size. And all the students in your art classes would work together to build those models through that work, through creating those giant sculptures. What do you think you learned?
Well, I learned early on in my teaching career that junior high students were fascinated by things that were very, very small or things that were very, very large. And I've always felt as a teacher that art lends itself very well to all the other disciplines that students encounter through their education program in junior high. So building the giant sculptures became, I think, the ultimate lesson in cooperative learning. Students were required to use math skills. At one point in time, we built a pair of Shaq shoes for in honor of Shaquille O'Neal. And the students wanted Shaquille O'Neal to come to Cedar Falls for our unveiling. And I let them know that, well, he won't come if you don't invite him. So we had a committee of students whose job on this mega sculpture project was to correspond with Shaquille O'Neal and see if we could get him to come here. And it was a very unique learning experience for those students. They hit some roadblocks, but they eventually came. We didn't quite get the job done, but they came very close. They were corresponding directly with Shaquille O'Neal's agent. And I believe if he hadn't become Rookie of the Year that year, he certainly intended to come to Cedar Falls.
If he hadn't had that good a year.
Yes.
Oh, that's very funny. So when you when it came time for you to retire from teaching, was your goal to become a full-time artist?
I've always been a full-time artist or active artist, mm-hmm. from my earliest years in school. But I realized that when I retired that I would have the time and the opportunity to continue my art in greater depth. So my wife and I bought a small acreage north of New Hartford and built a new house. And included in that house was a wonderful art studio and workshop so that I could pursue my interest in art.
And looking at the artwork on your website, williamcloseart.com, you work in two very different mediums. You have a gallery of pastel paintings, but you also have a gallery of wood sculpture. When did you first start developing these two very different kinds of artwork?
Well, actually, they pretty much developed in parallel lines. My earliest artwork was as a watercolorist. I later became interested in pastel, and I've always had a love of woodworking. And I feel I was inspired somewhat by the work of Grant Wood, who made such beautiful art, and his subject matter most often was the landscape of Iowa. And I love the landscape of the Midwest. And what I began to discover was that the patterns that we see in our hills and our row crops and our streams and lakes, the patterns and textures that we see are also very evident in the natural grains that we find in the wood of Iowa, the walnuts and the oak trees and the sycamores. So what I began to do was to transfer those patterns that I find naturally in wood into images, and I would rely on the texture of the wood to recreate the images that I had been painting with pastels and watercolor. It was a very natural transition.
So when you are traveling around Iowa or going for a hike or camping or in the Midwest and you see something that inspires you, what do you do to capture that image?
You know, I originally had a goal that I was going to create an artwork for every county in Iowa, and I was going to reproduce that either in pastel or in a wood painting. And it was the Des Moines Register that first labeled my work painting with wood, and I think that's a pretty accurate description of what I do. But I try to find either unique historical elements to an area in Iowa or the Midwest, or I rely on the natural beauty. People from outside the Midwest think that Iowa's flat, and Iowa certainly is not flat. We have beautiful rolling hills, lots of timber that still remains, and I capitalize on those images.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with painter and woodworker William Close, who lives near New Hartford, Iowa now. And you can see his artwork on his website, williamcloseart.com. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about art inspired by nature and also by community. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about a large-scale collaborative art project that has just been unveiled at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. My guest right now takes a lot of inspiration from the Iowa landscape and other beautiful natural scenes around the Midwest. William Close, he lives outside of New Hartford and was an art teacher at Pete Junior High in Cedar Falls for 33 years. You can go to his website, williamcloseart.com, and see some of his paintings and also some of his woodwork as well. And we were talking about where you get inspiration for your work before the break, Bill. Do you work from photographs? Do you take pictures?
I do both. I take photographs. I also have a friend who's an excellent photographer, and she takes photographs for me. And I also do pastel paintings, plein air. I'll visit a site and work directly from nature, which is something that I really enjoy doing while I'm traveling throughout the Midwest.
If you do that, how long does it take you to paint a scene standing outside with your easel?
I would guess probably 3 or 4 hours. There are painters that are much more spontaneous than I am, probably, but I'll set up my easel and have my pastels and work directly with the scenery that's presented before me, and 2 or 3 hours will pass very quickly.
How does that experience differ from working from a photograph?
Probably from a photograph, I will pay more attention to detail. If I'm painting plein air or, directly from nature, I work more on capturing the textures and the shapes that I see. And often I will bring that piece back to my studio and rework it somewhat and get more detail. So when I'm painting directly from nature, I try to capture the essence of what I see a little more quickly than I would working in my studio.
I was looking through the images on your website, and of course, being someone who lives in Iowa and loves Iowa, I was thinking, wow, looking at your Amana Hills, I've seen that, I've been there. And then I got further down, and you have a painting called Bluebells, and I thought, not only have I been there, I think I've been to that exact spot. Is that inspired by the Greenbelt in Cedar Falls, Iowa?
Absolutely. I try to visit there every spring.
And, so do I.
And I think that the bluebells depend upon a significant flood, because it seems following a flood, the bluebells are just explode.
And it was a wonderful spring for bluebells this year.
Absolutely. I went there and I said, I have to. And I have a couple more paintings I'm working on from the photographs I took that day. It's a very short-lived but a unique opportunity for people in the Waterloo and Cedar Falls area, and I'm sure at other places around the state of Iowa, to see this carpet of bluebells that just explode early in the spring.
Well, your painting is beautiful. I can smell them when I see the picture.
Well, thank you.
And I also noticed that there are some landscapes that you paint, but you also do a lot of very up-close work with flowers, with purple cone flowers, for example. How is that different for you, painting a landscape or really digging and painting that detail?
Well, I have about 3 acres of prairie that we planted 10 years ago now, and it's reaching maturity. My love for the Midwest is inspired by large, massive landscapes. It's also inspired by perhaps just a single flower. And the purple coneflower, for example, I love the texture, the unique designs of the center pod of that flower. So as quite often, I will try to focus on very small portions of our landscape and create an art piece involving just one or two flowers.
You mentioned how you can paint something in the field and then bring it back and fill in and add detail. And paintings are for a lot of artists, really ever-changing until they decide they can't touch it anymore. With woodwork, I imagine it's a very different process, because once the wood is cut, it's pretty unforgiving. How is that a different feel for you as an artist?
Well, it is a little bit different, but surprisingly, wood is very fluid. It's very malleable. I love the colors and the textures. I love the smell of wood. I have just recently returned from a trip to the Northwest. I took a piece to Seattle because in that part of the country, woodworking is a very significant art form. And I've left a piece at a gallery there, and I hope to be able to continue sending some work out to that part of the country.
But, do you find that you do a lot of traveling with your art to festivals, etc.?
I do. I go to 3 or 4 art festivals every summer. And it's hard work. It's a very time-consuming process, but I enjoy it. And I have patrons that come to see my work as I return year after year to various festivals. And it's an enjoyable way to interact with people and to show off my art.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be here, Charity.
I've been talking with William Close. He is a painter and woodworker who lives outside of New Hartford, Iowa. Again, you can see some of his work at his website, williamcloseart.com. And now, art inspired by community. A new exhibit recently opened at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. It's an opportunity for artists and community members to get involved in making the art on display. It's called Colony Figge and is being presented in collaboration with the Flux Foundation, a nonprofit organization that encourages people to design and build large-scale public art. Heather Aronson is here with me. She is Education Programs Coordinator at the Figge Art Museum. Hello, Heather.
Good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me.
And Peter Kimmelman is also here. He's founder and director of the Flux Foundation. Hello, Peter.
Hello. Good morning.
So, Heather, can you describe for me what, if I went to the Figge Art Museum today to look at this project, what would I see?
Well, it's a little different than your regular installation or exhibition. When you walk into the gallery space, you'll see a big grid on the floor made of plywood, and then we have tables. And we have lots and lots of cardboard pieces called snaps. And they are square pieces with cuts in them, and SNAP stands for Socially Networked Art Panels, and that was coined by the Flex Foundation. So these, all these individual identical squares have been cut and placed, and then people interact with them, and then it's like a giant puzzle piece. People take their SNAP and make it their own with markers or crayons, or they write their sayings or life mottos or draw pictures or write something about their visit, or sometimes it's just, I was here on this date. And they add it to this giant 3D puzzle piece almost. So it just builds on each other. Each piece snaps together and builds this big freeform sculpture.
And when you look at it, mm-hmm. is it beautiful? What do you see?
It is. It's interesting. It draws you in because you're instantly drawn in to see what everybody's written or drawn. Or we just installed this Friday, so Saturday it opened, and I popped in once over the weekend to check on the progress. And when I came in this morning, I was just delighted because there was all these new pieces and people commenting. And I mean, we have, you know, sayings like, people's sayings from everyday life, or quoting books, or even referring to their religions. And then we have, you know, Samantha was here on Saturday, you know, so it's just really fun. And it's just a really great reflection on who's visiting the museum and making their experience part of our experience. So that's what we hoped for.
Peter, this is the brainchild of the Flux Foundation, of you, and you have sponsored these large installations in other parts of the country. What is your goal with these large-scale public art projects?
Well, we would view artwork as an opportunity to really expose and explore the social connections that people have. So the idea behind Colony is physically manifesting something that we've become more common with Facebook, you know, a sort of, you know, data is connecting us all. In this case, it becomes a physical, animate object that enables you to really perceive the connections that you have with others around you and between you. For us, you know, artwork is an interactive experience, not only in its production, in making the piece, but also experiencing the piece. You know, by creating an activity or an experience or a moment out of your ordinary existence, it enables you to make a connection between the people around you who are doing the same thing. Whether they're there at the moment or were there yesterday, it doesn't really matter for us. You begin to see and experience each other through a mediating object.
What was the first time you did a Colony project like this?
So the first time we did it full with a group called the Museum Group, which is a bunch of museum professionals from around the country at their annual meeting in Minneapolis. And not only did we give a little talk there, but we really wanted to go beyond just saying words. As artists, we wanted to make something. So each at that conference, we gave a panel to each of the 5,000 people who came to the conference. And they all engaged, and it became a way of anonymous people to interact with each other and to get to know their colleagues and community members in a radically new way. And at the end of it, you know, one was presented with a physical object that one could change and alter and engage with, you know, beyond just the usual talking points and chit-chat.
Well, and Heather, when we talk about these cardboard panels, I think probably a lot of people imagine them snapping together in really a two-dimensional way, but this is three-dimensional. Not only are you creating something on the panel, but then you're creating sculpture with the panel, right?
Correct, yes. You choose where you're going to put your snap on the bigger sculpture, so you can place it wherever you like to. And we actually met the Flux Foundation at that conference. That was our first interaction with the Flux Foundation. The Figge staff was at the big American Alliance of Museums conference. And I think our staff got a little crush on the Flux Foundation at that time. You know, we were fascinated with what they were doing, and we really enjoyed speaking with them, and we all took part, and we all made our own snap, and we put it in there, and we just kept talking and talking about it. So it was just, I'm glad we had that opportunity.
Go ahead.
One thing we enjoy doing is not only just creating art, but rather creating artists. So that, we really try to bring the artist out of everyone. And by engaging with the piece, by creating a sculpture, you learn to not only engage with the history of the piece or the history of art, in other words, the work that people have done before you, but also learn to experience what it is to be an artist in dealing with things beyond your control, like gravity, the way things connect, the kind of space that you want to make. It really creates an experience that goes beyond just the object. And you are an artist, and everyone has an artist inside of them. And we really view bringing that out of people as the most positive experience that art can be.
Well, and you mentioned gravity. I can imagine that sometimes when these colony projects are put together, they don't stand up that well.
You might have to choose a different place. You might have to put it in a little differently than you pictured. And PK, I just want to say I love what you were saying about that. You know, at the museum, we're always looking for ways to get our visitors to interact with us and to make them feel like, oh, is this a big, scary museum and we're looking at all the pretty art on the walls, but that's all we can do here. You know, we're always trying to get them to interact and to comment or, you know, to make it a bigger connection. And giving these pieces to people and encouraging them to react to them it's kind of freeing. It's kind of fun to see what people do. And, you know, they may be timid or they may be, you know, I want to do it right away. Or they might be, oh, I'll take it and I'll think about it. But then they sidle over the table and they start drawing or they start writing. And soon enough, they have a big smile on their face and they're adding it in. So we're just so happy about that.
How long do you think on average somebody spends on one of these panels? Because I can imagine somebody saying, yeah, okay, I'll do it and spending just a couple of seconds. But I can also imagine somebody really digging in.
Well, it was really fun. The first people when we were installing was just our staff at the museum. So, you know, we have, you know, somebody that just wrote a big word on it. And then we had somebody that did a very intricate drawing. And then, you know, that goes on. When I popped in on Saturday to watch people, they, you know, some of the kids were, you know, really getting into it. And they were getting their parents or their grandparents to do it, too. And some people were just really staring at it and really thinking hard about what they wanted to put on there. And then, you know, like I said, I saw people that just said, you know, they just popped in and put a smiley face. Samantha was here on, you know, Saturday. And so it's all over the place. It's just really fun to watch all these unique individuals reacting with this identical piece. And, you know, that's what, I don't know.
How
as an artist, part of the fun is coming back to something, you know. You see artists in a museum, you know, redoing pieces and creating iterations of ideas. That's because once you start engaging with something, it's only then do you really begin to understand it and appreciate it. So someone hopefully will come back and, you know, after walking through the museum and have a new idea about something that they want to contribute or a new idea that they want to share. Or after spending time, you know, maybe the colony collapses a little bit, but now you understand how it works and you want to, you have a new idea of how to recombinate and recollect.
And how long will Colony be at the Ficke?
Colony is up for just a month. It's pretty fast. So it opens Saturday, and it'll be up through September 20th. It'll come down.
All right.
So it's just pretty fast. We had been wanting to do something like this and, you know, wanting to build on the Flux's idea and then have little colonies all over. And we took an opportunity. We had a window in the gallery that I wanted, the gallery space that I really wanted to use, and we jumped on it. So,
well, Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Heather Aronson is Education Programs Coordinator at the Ficke Art Museum. And Peter Kimmelman, thank you.
My pleasure.
Peter Kimmelman is founder and director of the Flux Foundation, and you can see Colony Ficke for the next month. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Tony Daner, and with me, Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up today?
Short and sweet. A message for you, Charity. You're not getting older. You're getting better. Actually, that's the theme of our show. How do we make that more than a cliche? Stay tuned at noon to find out.
We all need to find that out. Ben Kiefer, River to River, today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.